You are now listening to the eWatchmen podcast with your host, Robert King.
Another edition of the Watchman's Post podcast. I am on a roll, back-to-back weeks of programs. Woohoo! Yeah, baby! Well, you know, I mentioned in last week's program that I was having some recording problems. I was picking up a hum created from the electromagnetic force field associated with dimmer switches in the house here, and I was shutting off the circuitry, and last week I ended up shutting off the main breaker to the whole house, sitting in the dark, and that's just ridiculous. But technology to the rescue. I found a little microphone, actually manufactured by the same company that built the interface I was using with the Mac that was picking up the hum. But this little microphone, the Apogee mic, plugs straight into your Mac, even an iPhone or an iPad as well, and it doesn't pick up the hum. So I am happy with that. That problem is solved. Unfortunately, other problems crop up, you know, and that's why they call it life, I suppose. I had tweeted about this. I don't suppose most of you follow my little tweets, but I broke a little bone in my arm, chipped a bone in my elbow, lifting some hand weights. I went back too far doing what they call a tricep curl, and one bone knocked up against the other, and I thought it was just hyperextension, but the pain seemed to be getting worse instead of relieving, so I went to the clinic and took an x-ray and cracked it. A little chip. So anyway, my arm is in a splint. 4 to 6 weeks, he says, but I've broken bones before. I go into an emergency mode, ordered some Chinese bone healing herbs the other day. They should be here today, and hitting the wheatgrass juice. I think I'll probably have it mended in, I'd say, 3 weeks. Jehovah has built in some amazing healing properties into our bodies, hasn't he? Anyway, but that's not the only problem I'm dealing with. The same day I came home with my arm in a splint, my Mac keyboard went haywire, and not all of them, but some of the letters on the keyboard, like, for instance, I press A and it prints a Q. it's all messed up. So it has definitely put a crimp in my writing. My Mac's got a bug in it. I'm long overdue for a system reinstall. I've been putting it off, but I think I might just take it into the Mac geniuses and let them sort it out. I try to write every day, and even with my arm like this, I was pecking away, but I had a 6-8-page document that I was going to publish over the weekend, and it disappeared. And, you know, I'd saved it, and it's nowhere to be found. Gone into the cyber sheol, wherever. So anyway, I guess I've suspended my writing for the time being until I get mended and get some of these things sorted out. So, but it's actually easier now for me to speak into a microphone. So I thought in the interim I would record the Isaiah series. So I did chapter 1 and chapter 2 yesterday. I probably try to do a couple of chapters a day, and I think there's 29 editions in that series so far, although I'm nowhere near finished. I can do speech dictate, but even at that, you always have to do edits. I just need to get my Mac working again. So anyway, I've received a number of emails over the past few months, you know, asking for another podcast, encouraging me to get back in front of the microphone. So I'm happy to be here speaking to you, and I'm glad that I have an audience, really. I've received several emails recently in the last few days of people expressing their appreciation for the material I've published. Sometimes it seems like a thankless job, you know, and then there's always the detractors. And like somebody left a comment on one of my blog entries that I don't know if they're Jehovah's Witness, but not very knowledgeable, but they said that, "You're a liar. Babylon the Great, Jehovah's Witnesses do not believe that Babylon the Great is fallen. You're from your father, the devil." Okay. Actually, the Watchtower teaches Babylon the Great fell in 1918 or 1919, whenever. And, you know, and Jehovah's Witnesses or the International Bible Students were released from Babylonish captivity. Jehovah's Witnesses do not believe that Babylon the Great has been destroyed, but she has fallen. She has fallen. Get out of her, my people. Actually, it hasn't fallen yet, but Jehovah's Witnesses believe that it has. At any rate, I have gotten a few appreciative emails, and that is good to know, because it's, for the most part, kind of a thankless job doing what I do. I mean, I'm certainly not appreciated by the many of Jehovah's Witnesses. Yeah, by the way, if you are one of Jehovah's Witnesses, perhaps an elder, you know, I made a concentrated drive to contact elders with the last Kingdom Bulletin. And by the way, thank you. You know who you are for all the translations of Kingdom Bulletin number 7. I received several more the other day, so it's like in Chinese and Korean and Portuguese and German, Italian, Spanish, Dutch, Russian. It's amazing. But anyway, if you are an elder listening, how about this? You know, you receive objections from householders, and you try to answer their objections scripturally, right? But when those questions come from a fellow witness or one who's viewed as an apostate witness, then you see no obligation to answer. But I've challenged Jehovah's Witnesses to try to make sense of some of the things that you actually believe that the Watchtower has taught, and you have to believe that, right? But I've posted some months ago 30 questions for the Watchtower Society, or 30 questions for Jehovah's Witnesses based upon the teachings of the Watchtower Society. Most of the questions have to do with prophecy. So if you're up to the task, give those 30 questions a look over and see if you can answer them. Send me an email privately or post a comment on that particular blog entry, and we'd like to hear from you. Anyway, I do appreciate those who have offered help. Some have offered monetary assistance. The reason I'm commenting on these emails, because I haven't been responding to emails for the issues I've mentioned, the keyboard is messed up. So I thank you for your generous offers. I don't accept monetary contributions. I did for a short while, just a brief while, some years ago, but it complicates things for my personal income tax and all of that. So it's just better. And, you know, Jehovah has blessed me for the time being with financial resources. And so I'm not in any trouble in that regard. If you would like to help, though, my main goal is to contact Jehovah's Witnesses, primarily elders. As I mentioned, last campaign, Kingdom Bulletin number 7, I've acquired a little bit of a database for emails of elders. So if you're able to contribute that way, if you know of an elder's email, and why shouldn't you want them to be contacted with information that could help them hold their little flock together when things go haywire? And if you believe the information I've put across here, we're headed off the cliff, and Jehovah's Witnesses are oblivious to it. I mean, after all, Jehovah's Witnesses go out and try to contact people who did not necessarily invite them to come knock on their doors. Why should Jehovah's Witnesses object if they receive an uninvited email discussing vital information? So anyway, that's what I would like help with. Someone with whom I've been in email contact with for several months sent me a PDF copy of a letter to all the bodies of elders that was sent out by the Watchtower last October. And it's staggering to me that the Watchtower says that if a brother is known to be a child molester, it doesn't necessarily disqualify him from serving as an elder in his congregation. But it's not up to the local body of elders to make that decision. You know, as the process goes, if the elders would recommend this man, I don't know why they would, but if they were to recommend him, then the recommendation goes to the branch, and the branch will determine that whether or not he is a known child molester in the community, right? Because of the requirements in the scriptures that a man has to be irreprehensible and having a good report from those on the outside. So apparently, if he's not known in the community as a child molester, if he's not on the, you know, offenders list or whatever, then they might go ahead and appoint him. Well, the question is, do the parents in the congregation over which an unknown child molester could be an elder, how would they feel about that? He would be unknown. They would never announce it in the congregation that Brother so-and-so molested a child several years ago, but he's cleaned up his act, and we feel that now he'll make a good elder. And, of course, he's going to work with your children and field service and blah, blah, blah. To me, it is ridiculous and reckless. And I think I would have had an article up by now and put this PDF up as well so you can take a look at it, but these issues I'm dealing with, but it will be up. I was writing, and the article had vanished. I try to stay up on everything the Watchtower teaches, but, you know, I was unaware of a little change they made back in 2008. You know, they've always said that the dragnet, you know, Jesus' parable of the wheat and the weeds, and then he gave a similar illustration, the kingdom of the heavens is like a dragnet, and they haul the dragnet upon the shore and separate the suitable fishes from the unsuitable. And Jesus said the angels would be doing this work during the conclusion of a system of things. Well, the Watchtower used to say that was Christendom, and the dragnet was hauled up on the beach back in 1919, whatever. Now they say that the Watchtower is the dragnet, which I've said all along, except it hasn't been hauled up on the beach yet. Well, they say it has. And the unsuitable fishes are supposedly those who have some involvement with the organization. They may be studying, they may go to meetings, they may go to the memorial, but they don't follow through and they don't serve Jehovah as Jehovah's Witnesses do. And the Watchtower says those are the unsuitable fishes that are cast out. Well, think about this, because this is really blasphemous to think that the angels would drag somebody away from Christ's congregation. Because that's what Jesus said would be done in his parable, that the angels would make this separation. And here the Watchtower is saying that some person who's struggling maybe to come to terms with the truth, they're studying. You know how difficult it is for some people. It may have been that way for you, but if you're an active witness or have been, you know, you've conducted Bible studies, you go to someone's home and they're trying to get things sorted out. They may come to meetings and they just don't quite get the sense of it. Are we to believe that the angels take them out? In that same 13th chapter, Jesus said that the sower casts the seed and some seed falls along the roadside and the birds eat it up. And he said that represented people who hear the word but don't get the sense of it. And Satan takes away the seed of truth from them. Satan, not the angels. So anyway, that's what I was writing about. And hopefully one day I'll get an article up examining that ridiculous, blasphemous teaching of the Watchtower. No, the conclusion of the system is a short period of time, and I believe that the Watchtower is the dragnet, is gathering persons, and when the conclusion of the system begins in earnest, the angels will make a separation. And Jesus said that very clearly, that when the Son of Man arrives in his presence, that one man will be taken and another left behind. One will be grinding at the mill and one will be taken, the other be left behind. A separation. So, okay, well, let's get to a few of the questions I have here. This is sort of a strange question. First, he comments on some other things and said he was glad that I didn't sugarcoat the message about all the faithful anointed having to die. So anyway, my question, do you really think that Satan goes to heaven, or any of the demons for that matter? It would seem to me that the evil spirits would stay far away from their old faithful angel buddies, he called them, because they are so diametrically opposed to each other. How is it that Jesus and his angels need to evict him, Satan? Okay. Well, it's interesting, you know, when in the book of Job, when Jehovah confronted Satan, he asked him, "Where have you come from?" And Satan said, "From roving about in the earth and walking about in it." And yet there Satan was, in heaven, in an assembly of righteous angels. But it has suited God's purpose to have Satan there, because God intends to solve these issues that Satan has raised. And that's why he confronted him. He said, "Where have you come from?" And then he said, "Have you set your heart upon my servant Job?" So God invites Satan to, you know, articulate his issues before all the other angels. He wants to get it all out in the open. It's all going to be solved to Jehovah's vindication. It's interesting, though, that the demons who were associated with Satan wanted to be on the earth. They were the sons of God before the flood who came down. They forsook their proper dwelling place in heaven, says in Jude, during the days of Noah, and they married women. They wanted to be men. They were supermen, apparently. They took as many wives as they wanted. I suppose when they materialized, they didn't, you know, materialize some homely guy with buck teeth. And, you know, they were a very attractive, manly men that women found irresistible. You know, they were like rock star super athletes all rolled into one on steroids, you know, whatever. Have to use your imagination. But that's, boy, it's strange, you know. Humans seem to want to be angels, and angels, some of them wanted to be humans, and dogs want to be cats and all that, I don't know. But anyway, it's interesting that Jehovah evicted those unfaithful sons from the earth. During the flood, they obviously couldn't keep in a material body floating around in the water. So they dematerialized, and Jehovah put them under restraint, apparently, forbidding them to rematerialize. And he forced them into the spirit realm. And at that time, they were able to go back among their former buddies, their former brothers, really, in heaven. You know, it seems that, though, that the angels, or the demons, rather, want to be where the action is. And when Jesus was on the earth, you recall, he would expel the demons from individuals. And on one occasion, with the man that was demonized in the graveyard, actually there were two of them, according to one gospel account, and Jesus ordered the demons out, and they begged Jesus not to send them out of the territory. Well, why not? They wanted to be where Jesus was, where the action was, where this issue was focused. They were intent on tempting and tricking and tripping Jesus up to get them to their side, to prove Satan's contention that no man, skin on behalf of skin, bone on behalf, you know, no man will obey Jehovah if his life is on the line. And so they were intent, their lives were on the line. If they could prove that Satan was right, here's the only begotten Son of God, he's supposed to be faithful, we're really going to get this guy. If we can get him, hey, we might have a chance of living, because Jehovah's condemned us. And so that's, they want to be where the action is, and in heaven, I suppose there's opportunities for them to tempt other angels. And but when the kingdom comes to power, as it mentions there in the 12th chapter of Revelation, then it's time to, you know, bring things to a conclusion. And just as the demons were evicted from the earth at the flood, well, Michael and his angels battle with the dragon and his angels, and they lose and are evicted from heaven. They're still in the spirit realm, which can be considered heaven, but they're not in Jehovah's heaven. So they're confined to the earth. And, of course, Jehovah's Witnesses believe that happened in 1914. I point forward to the future for earth-shaking, absolutely earth-rocking event that will coincide with the ouster of Satan and his angels from heaven. We're getting close. You know, a lot of, over the years, you know, I keep watch on the comings and goings of events, and I don't have a crystal ball, but I do know what the scriptures foretell, and I have disproved, and I don't use that word lightly, I've disproved the entire 1914 doctrine of Jehovah's Witnesses. And so by doing that, I have some bit of insight into the future. For example, in the 8th chapter of Daniel, it speaks about this last king, and he will be a king fierce in countenance, and he will bring to ruin the mighty ones of this world, along with the holy ones. Well, the Watchtower says that happened during World War II. And yet they give no explanation of who these mighty ones were who were brought to ruin. And they claim, of course, that the holy ones are associated with the Watchtower. How were they brought to ruin during World War II? Well, Hitler couldn't bring them to ruin, sent them to the concentration camps by the hundreds. They came out victorious. So, but it's a future event. And I think the bringing of the mighty ones to ruin is the collapse of the present financial system. And the mighty ones are the billionaires and millionaires, the wealthy individuals that control what goes on this planet for the most part. They're going to be brought to ruin. And a lot of people now are saying that we've reached the end of this financial system. And even people that are part of this financial system, like there was a quote last week from a guy, Bill Gross, who runs PIMCO. It's the largest bond trading company in the world. He manages, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. Well, he came out and said, we're on the edge of a debt supernova, a Bond supernova. It's going to far, far surpass the near collapse of the financial system a few years ago. And he's not the only one saying that. So I think we're on the edge of this globe-rocking event. Things are shaping up. I don't think they'll just collapse the financial system. I think they'll probably, it'll be associated with another big shock like 9/11, maybe using weapons of mass destruction, some big boom, and wake up the next day, there'll be no financial system. Banks will be shut down and martial law, you know, army tanks in the street and all of that. And that will serve as a wake-up call. And I'm sure a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses, the light will go on for them, and they're going to start, they're going to be receptive to some of the things I've been talking about. Whether they'll still be an internet then, I don't know. But I'm proceeding as if there will be. I don't know. So anyway, I guess that answers that question as good as I can answer it. Another, this is actually a very profound question. He says, I feel compelled to ask this question. Can you explain what is the difference between right and wrong? According to Jehovah, of course. And then, what is the worldly answer to this question? Well, I think the simple answer is everything that Jehovah says is right is right. And what Jehovah says is bad is bad. And when humans or angels or any other moral agent tries to come up with their own standard, then they get into trouble. Going back to the Garden of Eden, Jehovah determined that a certain tree was his special property. He'd given Adam and Eve everything. The earth, it's all yours, all the flying creatures of the heavens, all the animals. You can eat from every tree. Just don't touch this tree. If you do, it's bad. An evil thing will come upon you. You will die, right? That's not good. You will die. And then after, of course, they disobeyed God, God spoke to someone, evidently the same entity whom he was speaking to when he said, let us make man in our image. He says, here they have become as one of us, knowing good and bad. So knowing good and bad means, in that context, that they had decided for themselves. And God has given us this agency. We can decide for ourselves. But it's not good. It will end up badly if we decide for ourselves what is good and bad rather than accept what Jehovah says is good and bad. And obviously, God said, if you eat from this tree, you will die. And Adam and Eve are dead. And I'm sure they regretted their decision. And, you know, their sin lives on in us, doesn't it? So even though Jehovah gives us the right to choose, we don't have the innate ability to really determine what is good and bad. But God has implanted in us an ability to discern what he says is good and bad, and that it is good. For example, Paul said, prove to yourself the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And when God created Adam and Eve, he gave us that faculty to a faculty of conscience that we can determine if our own course of action is right or wrong. Paul mentioned this in his letter to the Romans. He said, for whenever people of the nations that do not have law do by nature the things of the law, these people, although not having law, are a law to themselves. They're the very ones who demonstrate the matter of the law to be written in their hearts, where their conscience is bearing witness with them, and between their own thoughts, they are being accused or even excused. So, according to most people in the world, people have no contact with the Bible or education, most societies of people realize that it's wrong to murder your fellow man. It's wrong to steal, to take something from your fellow man. It's wrong to hurt someone. It's wrong to lie. That's not saying that people refrain from those things. Like I said, Paul said, you know, their consciences may excuse them even when they do bad things. But God has implanted that within us. But then Jehovah's law requires more than that, doesn't it? Just the main the main things. It gets tricky. For example, the Bible's pretty plain about blood being God's special property. But if we didn't read the Bible and meditate and study it, we would never know that. So we could be sinning against God and not even know it because we're unaware of his will in a particular matter. And it's interesting, the scripture I alluded to about Paul said, this very matter demonstrates the matter of the law to be written in their hearts. Jehovah foretold that those who are in the new covenant, that he would eventually take away all their sin and give them a heart of flesh rather than a heart of stone. And he would write his law within their hearts. Well, the Watchtower says that, you know, anointed Christians already have that within them. I don't think that is to be the case. I think it occurs when the kingdom comes, and of course when the resurrection, first resurrection begins, and when the final sealing begins. And then when Jehovah plants his law within their hearts, that means they really do become as Jehovah and Jesus, knowing good and bad. And they become immortal and incorruptible. They are implanted with a love for Jehovah's law that really will prevent them from ever being disloyal. And that's why God gives them immortality. He knows they will never, ever disobey him. Whereas at present, it's possible for a person who's anointed to become apostate, to disobey God. So obviously, they do not have the law written in their hearts. If something is written in your hearts, it's indelibly impressed upon you. That's what that concept is all about. Right now, Paul said now, he said he's a slave to God's law with his mind. He said, with my mind, I am a slave to God's law. With my flesh, I'm a slave to sin's law. So that's not the same as having God's law written upon our hearts. We're a slave to it in our minds. We're fighting to do the right thing, but it's still a fight. And when it's written in our hearts, it won't be a fight anymore. It will just be part of us. Okay. Now, this is the kind of question I don't prefer to deal with. And the new setup I have, I've tried to make it easier for people to contact me. I have a contact page and all that. And a person may or may not give a return email address. And this person didn't, because I would much prefer to respond to this sort of question in private. But here you go. I am pregnant by a JW who was disfellowshipped a year ago and is now attending meetings. He does not acknowledge me. And I want to know if it is because he is returning, and that's standard behavior. Talk about good and bad. And actually, no, that's not standard. You know, even people who are not Christians recognize that if they are responsible for fathering a child or impregnating a woman, that they are responsible for that new life that is being developed. So he obviously has some issues. But you should know that just because he's going back to meetings, if he's still disfellowshipped, Jehovah's Witnesses are not fellowshipping with him either. So it might be something more personal, that he is simply evading responsibility. The elders might be interested to know the situation there. But I would prefer not to get involved in this. This is a very personal deal, and I wish you the best. Well, I mentioned last week someone had written a 5 or 6 page email that I hadn't really acknowledged or tended to, and this issue about the new covenant and whether all Christians are in the new covenant. And I considered part of his question last week about the resurrection, and so I saved this part about the new covenant. And I'll try to get with this, although I think this is an issue, a topic that I'm going to be speaking about until, well, until Jesus returns, right? He says that it appears that your understanding of the new covenant remains very much like the understanding as written by Pastor Russell, an understanding that the organization is held to despite rejecting many of his other teachings. On the taking of emblems, I can state with certainty that if I were alive during the early 1900s and had read the Passover of the New Creation, found in Volume 6 of Studies in the Scriptures, especially reading from the heading, Who May Celebrate, I would have been partaking regularly at the Lord's evening meal from baptism. At present, I do not participate because I had never really considered properly whether I, as a Christian, should actually do so. I took it at face value that I should not, as I had been taught that the door was shut and the call had ceased. On reading the scriptures over several years, and particularly John 6, along with discussions with a fellow witness who was unsure of his calling, I have looked further into this matter. It does appear that even in the days of Pastor Russell, many people were unsure of their hope or calling. The pastor discusses this problem in his scripture study volumes. So the statement made from the platform at the Kingdom Hall during the memorial that those who partake would have no doubt but be 100% sure is clearly misleading. To suggest that Jesus is the mediator of only 144,000 people seems to me to be ridiculous. Considering that the scriptures talk about Christ reconciling a world to himself, and the ministry of reconciliation synonymous with the ministry of the new covenant, I find it highly doubtful that the new covenant was designed for 144,000 people. And then he quotes from Matthew 19:28, where Jesus referred to the recreation, and then he cites Titus 3:5 that uses that same Greek word, says, owing to no works in righteousness that we had performed, but according to the mercy he saved us through the bath that brought us to life, or regeneration, and through the making of us new by Holy Spirit. All right, well, I'm going to stop it right there. As Jehovah's Witnesses, I think we've been given a great gift in understanding that God has a purpose, right? His purpose is to create a new heavens and a new earth, right? Now, you can talk to people that believe in Jesus, that common, typical churchgoer, they have no understanding what that means. They think God is going to create a new planet or something, blow this one up. But we realize that God's purpose for a new heaven and a new earth is to create a new system, a kingdom that will rule over this planet. It will depose Satan from ruling as the God of this system of things and install Jesus and those who will be co-rulers, who will be kings and priests along with Christ, judges of angels, actually, according to Paul. And God's purpose is to accomplish his original purpose, which was, as he told Adam and Eve, fill the earth, subdue it, have in subjection the fish of the sea, and so forth. Now, writing to the Hebrews in the second chapter of Hebrews, Paul said that we do not yet see all things in subjection to him. To whom? Well, obviously Adam's not around to have all things in subjection to him, and none of his offspring have been able to subject all things according to God's will. But God has given those things to Jesus. And yet now, we do not see all things in subjection to Jesus. Even though he was made a little lower than the angels and was made in the flesh to correspond with Adam. He's a second perfect man that God created, the last Adam, because he'll be the last perfect human that God creates. But by that means, God was able to repurchase all of humanity. Now, it's true that all things belong to God. You know, he said in this psalm, you know, if I were hungry, I would not say it to you. He said, the beast of a thousand mountains belong to me. So God, everything belongs to God, but we've been sold into sin. And so in order to reclaim us, God gave his only begotten son. And by Jesus' death, because he was in a likeness as a man, he became the adoptive father of humanity. All humanity now belongs to Jesus. He bought us. And his will is, Jehovah's will is that all of those who have died will receive a resurrection. And as we know, there'll be a resurrection of the righteous and the unrighteous. Well, I can assure you the unrighteous are not going to be resurrected to heaven. Jesus said that those who practice vile things will receive a resurrection of judgment. That does not necessarily mean they'll be condemned. It means they'll be on trial, as I've mentioned many times, on probation, like getting out of jail. We're going to see how you do. You're on parole. If you straighten out your course, you know, well, you'll find your freedom. If not, you're going back. So for those who are resurrected, many of them practice vile things, didn't know God. For a lot of them, it'll be a resurrection of life. But for some, it will be a resurrection of condemnation. They will not prove to be faithful. They will die again. And that's why the Bible speaks of a second death. It's a permanent death. Of course, there's a tiny percentage of people whose first death is also their second death. And those who will be put to death at Armageddon, that will be their second death. There'll be no resurrection for them. The Bible is clear. But obviously, this is in reference to an earthly resurrection. So Christ's ransom makes it possible for all the dead to be brought back to life as humans, as flesh. And, of course, at the end of the thousand years, that's why it says that the rest of the dead did not come to life until the thousand years were ended. Doesn't mean that they're literally dead. It means they're in a death-like condition. We're in a death-like condition now. We know we're going to die. We've inherited this sin from Adam. We know death is inevitable unless God intervenes and saves us. So at the end of that thousand years, then those who have responded positively to the teaching and the priesthood of Christ and his associate kings and priests, they'll receive life. They will no longer be afflicted with Adamic death, but they will still be subject to the second death. That means it's still possible for them to rebel against God, even as a perfect human, even as Adam and Eve did, even as the perfect angels did. Satan and his angels are going to receive the second death, to be sure. So we know that that's God's purpose, to reestablish paradise on the earth and have the earth full of humans who live forever in paradise. That's God's purpose. If you don't understand that, then you have no basis for delving into the deep things having to do with the new covenant and the first resurrection. Paul made it clear in John in Revelation that there's an early resurrection. Paul referred to it as the early resurrection, the better resurrection. And John referred to the first resurrection. Happy and holy are those who receive the first resurrection. The second death has no authority over them. Why doesn't it? They're immortal. They're perfect. They have God's law written in their hearts. They cannot sin. That's why the second death has no authority over them. The angels are subject to the second death. That's why the angels that sinned are going to die. They're going to be destroyed permanently, forever, erased, blotted out. No trace of their existence will remain. That's the second death. There are those who will not be subject to it. That's a huge, huge distinction between those who receive the first resurrection and those who receive a resurrection of judgment. So now you want to talk about the great crowd. Where's the great crowd? They come out of the great tribulation. Those who receive the first resurrection do not come out of the great tribulation. They die. You have to die in the flesh to receive a resurrection in the spirit. But obviously, the earth is not going to be uninhabited at any time. What's it say in Isaiah? That I shall make mortal man rarer than refined gold. It's going to be a huge depopulation, but not all will be liquidated. God is going to cut short the tribulation in order that some flesh may be saved. So God's will is to have people survive the horrific end of this system of things, just as Noah and his family survived the flood, and they got out of the ark a year later and onto a new earth, so to speak. And so those that come out of the great tribulation will be in the flesh, and they, of course, will still be imperfect, but they will be under the guidance and protection of the kingdom of God. What's it say in the 21st chapter of Matthew, excuse me, of Revelation, that New Jerusalem comes down out of heaven and God spreads his tent over mankind? They will be his peoples and he will be their God. Peoples on earth will become the children of God, and he will protect them and wipe every tear from their eyes, and death will be no more. Mourning, nor outcry, nor pain. They'll all be done away with. The things of this rotten old world, dying of some hideous disease, a cancer, heart disease, that'll be over. And all we have to do is obey the kingdom, and obey the dictates coming from Christ. He will lead all those survivors to the waters of life and never again lose a loved one in death, unless, of course, they sin against Jehovah. And you won't shed any tears over them, I promise you. But see, we have to understand this basic elemental truth about what God's purpose is before we can grasp what the new covenant is. Because it's also Jehovah's purpose. Christ's death and resurrection bought all of mankind, but it also makes it possible for some to be anointed and taken into a covenant with Christ. They become one with Christ, part of his body. Now, there are more than just 144,000 who are called, but unfortunately, some prove unfaithful. But ultimately, it is God's purpose to have 144,000 chosen ones. They're chosen, they're called, they have to prove themselves. But ultimately, God's purpose will succeed. I think that, you know, I wrote an article some time back that I realized that, I mean, Jehovah gives Satan every opportunity to make the case, and Jehovah trumps him on every issue. I mean, this whole business, going back to Eden, where, you know, Satan said that God was keeping something back, and he essentially intimated that God can't trust his creatures, and his creatures don't really love him anyway, you know. Satan was basically arguing, hey, look, I am not that wicked. Everybody is self-interested. Everybody's really like me. You can't make a creature that will be loyal to you under test. Huh? Jehovah has proved otherwise. Christ's really proved that Satan was a liar, but Jehovah gives Satan every opportunity. So when we get into the time of the end, Jehovah, of course, is going to thrash the remnant. They're going to be put through an ordeal. But then Jehovah reclaims and reconfirms his love for them and gives them his Holy Spirit in full measure. and grants them entry into the kingdom. And what did Paul say as regards partaking of the evening meal? He says, you keep proclaiming the death of the Lord until he arrives. What happens when Jesus arrives? Well, the new covenant is concluded. The evening meal will no longer be celebrated when Jesus arrives. It won't be celebrated in the new world by those who are part of the earthly recreation. It ends when Jesus arrives. Why? Well, because those who are found finally faithful and approved will be made perfect in Jehovah's eyes because of the mediation of Jesus, as he's the mediator of a new covenant. And the purpose of the new covenant is to form a new creation, which is to be associated with Christ, to produce a kingdom of kings and priests with Jesus. So here, when Christ arrives and his mediatorship will come to a conclusion then, but those who are left remaining, the remnant who are left remaining after the first resurrection begins, will have to face Satan down in the flesh. And Jehovah sets this challenge before Satan. All you've got to do is cause one of these to be unfaithful, because I've already shut the door, right? Didn't Jesus say when the bridegroom comes and the virgins with oil in their lamp make it in and the door is closed, and then finally one fellow with improper attire is thrown out into the outer darkness? But the door is closed at that point when the bridegroom arrives, when Jesus arrives. So in other words, no one else will be anointed. So Jehovah is saying to Satan, I've got my team. Here are the last ones who are going to make up this kingdom. I've already stated in my word, 144,000. No one will be able to master the Song of Moses but this 144,000. So here's the last few ones. You want a shot at them? Have at it. If you can get one, it will be a huge embarrassment. You will nullify the word of God, because then there will only be 143,999 or whatever. But Jehovah knows that when he plants his law within their hearts, that they will never betray him and they'll be faithful to death. And their death will justify Jehovah in annihilating Satan and his world, because they will have killed the remaining ones of his sons, just as they killed Jesus 2,000 years ago. So they'll fill up the full measure of their sins, and Jehovah brings his judgment against them, beginning with Babylon the Great. So, you know, when Paul wrote to the Hebrews, he said that he was referring to Melchizedek, and he said, I have a lot to talk about. He was talking about he was a type of Christ and the priesthood of Christ. And he said that some things are hard to be explained, hard to understand and hard to be explained. And he said, and all the more so because you've become dull in your hearing. And I think that is the case with many of Jehovah's Witnesses who get confused over these issues, and they don't understand any longer a distinction between the little flock or the other sheep and the little flock. But I think you really do need to think long and hard about this idea that all Christians are anointed and all Christians are part of a new covenant, because it just ain't so. Well, I will probably be talking about this for some time, until he arrives, I suppose. But that's going to do it for me now. And I thank you for listening. I thank you for your supportive emails. I thank you for your interest. And keep the questions coming, because it keeps the podcast coming. You know, some of the questions I feel, you know, I answer in the mailbag, but keep my mailbag primed, and we'll keep the programs going here. So thank you again for listening, and may Jehovah bless your search for the truth.